You're listening to the Broadway Podcast Network.
Curb Dump Theater people, welcome to Your Program Is Your Ticket. My name is Sean Chandler, and I'll be your host. Your Program Is Your Ticket is a discussion of smaller theater works and the people and organizations that make it happen. Now, we normally come to you from Midtown Manhattan, but we've taken a field trip for tonight's show to the prestigious Vassar College in Poughkeepsie, New York. As many of you know, your program is your ticket is a helpful system where your program is literally your ticket to get into the theater in smaller, more intimate productions. It's these works we like to highlight, and it's our goal on this show to feature as many of these productions as possible while still discussing the biggies. I love theater and see as much as I can wherever I go. Now, during the travels of the production of my husband and my play At the Flash, I met many wonderful people from all over the world in the theater community, and it is my honor to bring them on as guests to the show. Tonight's guests are the playwright and director team of Theater 80 St. Mark's current production of In Love with the Arrow Collar Man, playwright Lance Ringel and director Chuck Munkle. Now, I'll be bringing those guys on in a few minutes, but before I do, I thought it would be nice to give you a little history of Theater 80. Theater 80 presents a range of productions from traditional forms such as Shakespearean theater and flamenco dance to the cutting-edge avant-garde and works from new authors. That's great. Theater 80 was first envisioned and built at 80 St. Mark's Place in the Lower East Side neighborhood of New York City. Now, here's a little history of the location. Beginning during Prohibition, 80 St. Mark's Place was a vital destination for performers of all kinds. Jazz greats such as Thelonious Monk, Harry Sweets Edison, John Coltrane, and Frank Sinatra performed there before Theater 80 was established. Now, it's a little tough to pin down, and maybe my guests can help me out a little bit today. It's tough to pin down when exactly Theater 8 was established within the location, but here's a couple of hints. During the 1970s and 80s, Theater 80 was utilized as a film revival house where people were able to see vintage films on a movie theater screen in an audience setting. Several great names in the theater have left their foot and handprints in the cement of their sidewalk. Isn't that cool? A partial list includes Gloria Swanson, Joan Crawford, Myrna Loy, Ruby Keeler, and Joan Blondell. That's neat. I can't wait to go and see that area. That sounds like a lot of fun. Now, the Greenwich Village Society for Historic Preservation recently recognized Theater 80 with the Village Award for its place in the history of the community. So congratulations on that. Theater 80 has helped create new audiences by welcoming both public and private school groups for matinees and tours of the theater, which have included schools from as far away as Toronto. I think that's terrific because I remember when I was a young kid and I was loving theater, I thought to myself, you know what, I want to know what goes on backstage. I think if you take a young kid who's like into theater, who's like maybe borderline, and you take them and you say, hey, I'm going to take you backstage, like, you've got them. They're in. They're theater lovers for life. I've often said, like, just put me backstage at like a musical and set me on top of a speaker. I just want to see everything that's happening, but I'm kind of a nerd that way. Finally, Theater 80 also provides the theater for free or at reduced rates for community meetings, local filmmakers, playwrights, 12-step meetings, memorials for members of the community, and has produced a benefit for Japan Tsunami Relief. So that's really cool. That's amazing. They're not only helping out the community, they're helping out the world and international. So congratulations to them, and I very, very much look forward to going to the show and seeing the theater. So great. Now to bring on their latest duo of accomplished artists. Folks, please welcome to the show playwright and director of In Love with the Arrow Collar Man, Lance Ringel and Chuck Munkle. Hi, Lance and Chuck, and welcome to Your Program Is Your Ticket.
Well, hi. Thank you for having us, Sean.
It's my pleasure. Thank you for being on the show. It's so nice. It's such a beautiful day out here in Poughkeepsie, New York. It was a great day to take the train down, and I don't know. I think this college is really fun and cool. And
it's one of the world's great commute rides on the train,
isn't it? Though,
yeah, from New York to Poughkeepsie.
Oh my gosh, I love that. I had the window seat, which normally David actually makes me give him the window seat. So I had the window seat, and I just sat there and listened with my headphones, and which I don't normally do. It actually distracts me from doing work on the train. So
there you go.
Anyways, tell our audience about In Love with the Arrow Collar Man, please.
In Love with the Arrow Collar Man is a major slice of cultural history that most people don't know about. And it's also a gay romance that most people don't know about. Everybody's heard of Norman Rockwell, but before Norman Rockwell, there was a gentleman named J.C. Leyendecker who drew most of the covers of the Saturday Evening Post before Rockwell.
Right.
And his first model for the Arrow Collar ads, Charles Beach, and they ended up together nearly 50 years.
Wow.
And they knew everybody. So there's this amazing story. There's only a couple nonfiction books about him, and there's never been a dramatization. And I decided to write it, and Chuck is directing it, and you'll see not only these two people, but Rockwell and colorful characters like Walter Winchell and Texas Guinan from the early part of the 20th century in it as well, because they knew everybody.
Wow, very colorful. Mm-hmm. Cool. How did this current production come about?
Well, we started with a 23-minute version of the show last year in the New York New Works Festival, which is produced by Gene Fish, and he is helping us out on this production. So we made the semifinals last year, and people were very excited by the story and the potential for it to be a full-out show. Because, again, they were only getting the 23-minute excerpt of the show last year. So one thing led to another, and we were able to finesse having it at Theater 80 for a bit of a show, an equity showcase run from November 8th to December 2nd, and we're in the middle of that, sort of winding down the last to the last few days, but we're as excited as we've been for the whole run to be in the middle of this world premiere of the show, of this story that people are just getting to know about.
We had the great good fortune that the actors who played Charles Beach and Joe Leyendecker were available to come back. So that was part of the timing of this, because they had done such a wonderful job last year, Ian Brodsky as Joe and Jack D. Martin as Charles.
That's terrific. Congratulations on making the semifinals and then your new production. That's awesome. Now, had you written the full script and then you guys parsed it down to 23 pages, or was it 23 pages and then you developed it?
The former. I actually wrote In Love with the Arrow Collar Man in 2010.
Wow.
And I had a couple major projects intervene in the meantime, and we kind of got back to it last year, looked at it, and looked at other things we'd written, and because we knew it was a 23-minute festival, and found out that this was one where the first two scenes plus something from the ending would make it work in that kind of setting, and it did. So this was the first time we got to do the whole thing, but yes, the whole thing was written before the segment was.
I had this funny experience last year submitting for festivals thinking, why are all the requirements 20 minutes?
Yeah.
People are not writing 20-minute plays, and then I realized that people are presenting an excerpt or portion of their show, and then the interest of the evening is you see five or six things in a given evening, and so you have an evening's theater entertainment. But you see a lot of different shows in process. Some of them have been written, some of them are just 10 or 15 or 20 minutes, and some, like ours, are a full show. So it's an interesting process leading up to the culmination of this production for us.
Having said that, we actually made the semifinals of New York New Works again with the only thing the two of us have ever written together, which is a musical that was, in fact, about 25 minutes called Animal Story.
Excellent.
And Chuck wrote the music, and I wrote the lyrics and book, and we were, I believe, 23 and 26, respectively, back when that happened.
That's
1978.
Great.
Yes.
Wow. So it made its debut on 42nd Street quite a bit later.
Wow. That's amazing, you guys. Now, how did you put together those 23 pages? I mean, did you just take a chunk out of the middle? Did you just shorten the play? Do beginning, middle, end?
This play worked to take the beginning and then just a piece of the ending so that the festival audience had some sense of closure in the shorter one. But it's basically, the play is basically six scenes, and we basically did the first two.
Wow.
And it worked well. Chuck has a wonderful musical that he co-wrote with his frequent collaborator, David Eisner, called Morning Becomes Ridiculous, which also was in the same festival last year. And we know how good it is, but it didn't excerpt as well, because sometimes that format just doesn't work so well for excerpting a good piece. So,
yeah. Now I see that Morning Becomes Ridiculous. This is off of your website,
yes,
Chuck.
Yes.
It won Best Book and Lyrics, Best Actor, Best Actress at the Manhattan Theater Mission's second annual showcase of musicals.
Right.
So that's great. What is Morning Becomes Ridiculous about?
Well, it's a funny, fun, turned upside down take of Sophocles' Electra, where suddenly the fates do not govern your lives anymore, mm-hmm. and you all have to take your free will and decide your future. And the people in the story are agog. They just can't
right.
figure that out. And so it causes for, you know, multiple mayhem, and they sort of collide and then decide to go on.
How fun.
So, yeah, it is. It is a lot of fun.
Now, did you modernize the story a little bit, or did you?
Well,
were you doing the
I say would say the language is a mixture. So we have a colliding, like for instance, there's a chorus, Chloe, Phoebe, and Laverne. So so they're great. A bit like your traditional women's chorus, but then they're like out of the fabric of our 20th century at the same time.
Wow. So. Well, I thank you for that, because I sometimes have a really hard time watching the Greek tragedies, reading them, as Shakespeare as well. And I'm very forthcoming about this, but sometimes the language, I have a problem with the language, because there's a translation that has to occur between the actor saying it and me figuring it out, unless, of course, you're a scholar of them, and by that time, you're three lines down.
Sure.
So
one of the funny collisions in that show is we do have a traditional chorus, which are called the victims of history, who are people like Oedipus and Cassandra,
sure.
who have been, the slashing wrists kind of lives in drama. And then they're called on things by the anti-chorus, the three women. So
what a cool idea.
They come in and out of the activity of the drama of the characters, and they wonder, they wonder the Aegean bemoaning life and their lot in life, and then these other three who have had a dream that told them everything is going to be different.
Opening song.
They just have to tussle and figure out now how is this going to be different.
Wow.
So it's a fun little piece that lasts about 75 minutes, and you're in and out, and you get this whole little story.
Excellent.
Yeah.
That's great. Now let's get back to In Love with the Yarrow Collar Man. Mm-hmm. How are the audiences reacting to the show? What are the comments you're hearing?
Wildly enthusiastic.
Very enthusiastic, but I suppose the most common comment is, I had no idea. I learned so much, but not because it's a lesson, although in fact it's framed as a lecture by a charismatic art teacher with projections and then flashing back to the lives of
right.
Joe and Charles.
Mm-hmm.
But so many people have come up and said, wow, this is just amazing. What a story, and it's true, and I had no idea.
That's great. Had no idea.
That is the bottom line reaction, I would say, for most people.
That's outstanding.
Mm-hmm.
You're educating people on a couple that had been together for years and years and worked together.
Yeah.
That's outstanding. Now, you two have been together for
41 years.
How often do you work together? Now, you're working together on this show, but have you worked together a lot in the past?
In the past year, we have done
six shows.
So we have had a concentrated period of doing this.
Oh, my gosh.
In the past 3 years, since Lance's World War One novel called Flower of Iowa
mm-hmm.
has come out as an ebook, we have been touring all over doing an evening's presentation of the book. We read the characters. I sing World War One songs, and people have just been totally charmed by that. So they get an idea of the book. Of course, here are two 60-somethings reading these two
18-year-old
characters.
On the
but
Western
people
front.
Just love it.
And why
it
not?
Keeps,
yeah.
So and it registers with them.
Yeah.
It doesn't matter. The emotions and the story are the same no matter who's communicating.
Sure.
So that's worked really well too. We've gone from across the country and back and to London, and Stephen Fry has tweeted about it, and it's been a really amazing experience.
And then we opened the International Dublin Gay Theatre Festival, which you're familiar with.
I am, yes.
In Ireland. This past spring with the reading. And we didn't think of it at the time, but doing the tour, we call it a little tour in a Hyundai because everything fits in the car.
That's great.
A Flower of Iowa actually ended up being very good practice for us for what we've done the last 2 years with these six different productions.
Wow. Now, tell me about working together. Talk about that a little bit.
It's obviously there's moments of friction, but it's probably more noticeable to people from the outside how few moments of friction there are,
mm-hmm.
Because we have been together for so long. We know each other's work. We did a play of Chuck's this summer called Running for My Life, which was the first production of that, which was in a festival that allowed it to be a full run. And I didn't really have much of a formal role, but it was important to both of us that I was there to be with him.
Well, that's not true, because you were the assistant director and the dramaturg. So sometimes he minimizes his contribution.
I kind of hate the title dramaturg.
Well,
but,
I know
but,
you do.
But it said when I looked
it
up
important.
That you have to get the playwright and the director talking to each other. And, of course, he was both, so I had to facilitate
And, of course,
that.
I would come into the cast, and he's there as assistant director. And they'd ask a question. I'd say, well, I'll have a consult with the writer, and I'll bring the result. Because I never wanted to feature being the writer, you know, holding for dear life onto the words.
Right, yeah.
And as the director, I just had to, and that's for my show.
Right, now for Eric Kollerman, I wrote it, he's directing it, so we've had a few moments. But mostly, I love the creativity that he brings to it and brings out in the young actors. And what kind of happens with us, because most everything we've done in the last year has been with young actors primarily, is that you sort of end up being dad and dad to the family of the company, and so you don't want to fight in front of the kids.
True.
But that's an amazing experience, because I feel almost like, I know we talk about, so where's the theater going, all those different questions that I know you have. That is what feels to resonate for us, that we're sort of making this a mission to give work to younger people. So many come in and they're just so incredibly talented, and to give them something to do and to let them be able to be freely creative apparently is something that isn't as common. I'm shocked at that, having been being an actor for 40 years and having a variety of good experiences, but some not so good ones at the same time. A lot of them just say, oh, thank you for even just getting back.
Just being nice to them, frankly.
Being nice to them and telling them,
wow,
we're sorry you didn't get the job,
sure,
but we keep a body of people for future work, and we do, and we've done that.
Yeah.
So it's really interesting to give them something of value to then have this familial family experience.
That's great philosophy. I remember when our play At the Flash was starting to take off, it was really my first taste of some success, of being, you know, of dealing with this. And I am so fucking neurotic that, like, I have to have a therapist teach me how to be successful. But this was a lady that was used to dealing with artists. And she said, if you always remember that, keep your relationships as the primary goal. Just focus on the relationships. Make that the priority. And everything else will fall into place.
Mm-hmm.
Took a while to understand that, but she was absolutely right. It's for a couple reasons. First of all, because you have a reputation now for being artists who have sympathy and empathy. And that's terrific. That's really, really important. And I'm just going to say it, sanity.
And it's true. Well, it helps us all keep it and keep the perspective on the business by keeping our integrity and sanity about our integrity as much as we can. I mean, obviously, in the creative moment, we spin out to wherever we spin. But what I was going to say is, regarding some of those points, I find my sanity in the actors.
Right.
I, again, feel like I have a certain thing I can give them as a gift almost, but I get in almost because I say, I'm going to get in your faces and it's going to be like we're doing a movie. You know, I'm just trying to see where they're, what's the one's doing, what sure. the other's doing. And then that just enables the drama to spin out almost of its own accord. And that just seems to work.
Well, yeah, I mean, I think directors have to get micro at times. Mm-hmm. They do. They have to get in and make sure that those details are there. That's your job as a director.
Right. And to allow them to be creative, because I just say, bring everything you have for me, mm-hmm. and then we'll shape it. You know, if you have 10 choices or 100 choices, bring everything you have. I don't have a vision about how this has to be.
Right.
So that just is a way that works for me and has worked in these different experiences we've had together.
That's excellent. So, also, one of the reasons why she said to focus on the relationships is because there are so many ups and downs. And, you know, one year you're up here. The next year you're back in front of your computer writing and figuring stuff out again. And
just as the relationships as the you as real people.
Right. And as yes, if you do that, you're developing bonds with people that understand you. Mm-hmm. And who can empathize with you. And so anyways, that's just a little bit of psychology there for success.
But what it does, Sean, is it maintains your humanity in this business that can be so inhumane.
Indeed.
So that's, I think, a really important thing.
Oh, yeah. It's probably the best piece of advice I've ever mm-hmm. gotten. In taking this ride. Boy, it's a crazy ride.
One of the ironies of us working together is Chuck has been an actor for 4 decades, so he's somewhat weary of some parts of the theater it's still new for me.
Uh-huh.
So it's an interesting dynamic because we kind of balance each other out that way.
Oh, that's great. It's good to have that balance. It's always nice when one person is kind of being neurotic and I'm going to speak from my experience working with my husband, David, who's sitting right over here. We work together in so many ways, and it's nice if we're in a place to where he's going crazy and I can be calm and vice versa.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah. And we don't tiff that much, but it's usually about silly things. But anyways, I digress into myself, which I shouldn't do on my show with my guests here. So thank you very much for the segue into your guys' feelings about the state of theater now. I appreciate that. These guys have been on the radio, and they know the drill. It's awesome. Are there any particular messages and themes that speak strongly to you and the projects you select to write or direct or act in?
Certainly, as a writer, between the novel that I have out and this play, I feel like LGBT history, because it got covered up and left aside, is really attractive to me because the stories are incredible, some of them, and they haven't been told. So to come across something like the lives of J.C. Leyendecker and Charles Beach and realize nobody's ever done a novel or a play version of it, and that I had the field to myself, is a wonderful thing for a writer to have. I think the most significant thing happening culture-wide is that all sorts of groups that have not been heard from are finally getting a chance to be heard from, and it's going to enrich our culture immeasurably over the coming decades.
Praised by Lin-Manuel Miranda as the future of musical theater, SUFF's creator Shana Taub makes Broadway history as only the second woman to write the book, music, lyrics, and star in her own original new musical. Don't miss the much-anticipated Broadway debut of the singular artist that Forbes calls visionary and Billboard anoints as one of the most inventive voices in musical theater. SUFF's The Original New Musical from Shana Taub is now playing on Broadway at the Music Box Theater. Get your tickets today at suffsmusical.com.
Terrific.
John? It would be nice to think that they will continue to be heard because certainly parts of our government are trying to tamp down people being heard. So I think we're going to be in a bit of a struggle. Maybe that is what what taps the creative energy anyway, when you have that struggle where someone's trying to hold things back and you can't. The dam just overflows. So sure. Stories will come rushing forward like this, or any good story to be told, I would say.
That worries me less.
Well, I understand that may worry you less. I'm just thinking from my point of view, what draws me is usually a good story and interesting characters rather than some flashy something or other, I guess. So it's I always feel character-driven is what speaks to me and what causes me to get excited about a project.
Great. So it sounds like just digging into where the intimacy is,
right,
where the relationships are. Reminds me of my friend Howard Margulies, our friend, I should say, who's actually been on the show. He's a playwright as well. He says he likes living rooms. That's just, I like living rooms. I like to put the characters in a living room and then see where they go. So
we have a living room segment in our play.
So. Good. what do you two think is an important direction theater is taking right now?
I would say, again, in the smaller venues, that there are stories being told. Even something like, which we haven't seen, but we talked about seeing Come From Away, which is a bigger venue, being that it's Broadway, it sounds like it's more story and character driven. And the characters get to play, and the actors actually get to play different roles.
Oh, yeah, it's
so
a great show.
I find that prospect to be appealing. We have done that in several instances in the shows that we have worked on. And it gives the actors interest, you know, another interesting thing to do. And when they can help spin out the drama by using their creativity, it just makes it all the more interesting, I would say.
That's actually a really good point and an excellent example, because that's a big show, but it feels small.
So that's what I hear. I mean, we haven't seen it.
Right.
But that is an interesting possible way that things are maybe that are spinning out a little more than they were. It felt like we were really into spectacle.
Right.
Totally for a while. But now I think maybe we are getting back to some character-driven stories.
Absolutely. Another good example of a show out right now that does that is The Band's Visit.
Okay.
That's directed by David Cromer. Mm-hmm. That's an excellent show that feels, it's big, it's in a big theater, but it feels really, really small and intimate. So I totally hear you. Lance?
When I said I was worried less than Chuck was about the political climate, I always like to say Ronald Reagan made Madonna possible.
Oh my gosh, that's great!
Yeah, because
that's a play in itself, right there.
The culture responds to what's going on politically, and usually in a counterpoint way. So I would guess that under what we're going under politically, that there's going to be a flowering probably of very good theater and movies and etc. Because the culture tends to react to that kind of attempts at repression at the top. That's been my experience over my lifetime, which is now 65 years and counting.
Way.
It is. Yes. I feel good about that, actually. Senior discounts are great.
You look good, too.
But anyway.
Don't worry. I'm getting the AARP emails myself.
Okay. Yeah, right. So it's going to, as I said before, to have more voices of African American playwrights, of Latino playwrights, sure, Asian American playwrights, LGBTQ playwrights, women,
yeah,
is going to change our culture for the better, because we've had a great history in theater, and I actually took a class here at Vassar on some of the best stuff of the last 150 years or so in America, but we've been mining relatively narrow amounts of people's experience. The more people's experiences we can mine for the great stories that are out there, the richer it'll be for all of us.
Wow. Excellent answer. Now, other than Come From Away and The Band's Visit, I know you guys, it seems like you're applying your answers to indie theater. Are there any particular shows, other than those, on your radar that aren't written by you? Or directed by you, that you feel exemplify this new vision that you're talking about
or direction of theater. And one of the tough things of being as active as we've been in the last year and a half with putting on six shows is we haven't gotten to see as much as we could.
That's a very common answer.
Let me just throw an answer, though, at you. It's not... Jack, who is plays Charles, was in a show this past summer called Sonder, which was very interesting because it was about a male-female couple and a male-male couple, and they actually never have met, and it's got a little bit of magical realism in it. And I just was watching it thinking this play couldn't have been written or put before an audience 10 years ago.
It's called Sonder?
Sonder, S-O-N-D-E-R, which is an expression about... as they explained, not in the play, but on the playbill of the Dan Moldovan was the playwright, that it's an expression meaning the awareness that somebody else, other people are leading lives as rich as yours.
Wow.
And it wasn't a perfect play, but I really was thoroughly taken by it. And because this young male-female couple moves into a house where a gay couple, a male couple, has been and died and years before. And then the two couples kind of interact but don't interact. And I thought this just wouldn't have been here with that kind of audience 10 years ago. And I thought that's cool that places like... And looking at the audiences that are coming to our play,
mm-hmm.
yes, there are certainly a goodly number of gay male theater goers, and particularly of a certain age, because one of my real concerns about theater is how many people have, you know, gray hair, period. Not that we don't love folks with gray hair, because we have it, but, you know, that you get younger people in there. But it is a more mixed audience than it would have gotten if we had done it even when I first wrote it, I think.
Wow, cool. Okay. Chuck, you have a...
Again, I feel... I don't know how I feel this needs to go or where my heart lies with it, except to work on these stories that do not get the light of day, you know, because you don't have the $2 or $10 million to do it on a Broadway stage and perhaps have it go down the drain because of a bad Times review or something
right,
like that.
Yeah.
So again, I go back to the mission of, if we could have more people trying to get younger people involved in the theater, then we could create a lot of little experiences like this that don't necessarily have to, you know, break the bank, but they can be of value and importance to get out there for the theater going public. It is something like these little shows then can be done off Fringe in London or, you know, wherever, whatever, other in Chicago in some little theater. It doesn't have to be the big, splashy, you know, tour Broadway show. So I'm not pinpointing any particular shows or writing or anything, but that's sort of what I'm feeling on
that's
the mission about these days.
A terrific, and I do have to say, a very original answer to that, because it feels like your focus is more of being sort of a pioneer of finding that, as
in
opposed
sense,
yeah, as opposed to saying that's what it is. You want to find it,
right?
And
I think that's exactly right.
That's a great answer. Now, you've touched on this a little bit, but what do you think is the best part of being involved in smaller, more intimate productions?
Well, the sort of family feeling you get is definitely part of it. And I think maybe for somebody who's at my point in life who's never had kids, the touching, being back in touch with young people, because small theater tends to be populated by young people,
sure.
Predominantly. I think that's one of the most wonderful things about it. And it also is about, as Chuck was saying, creativity. We don't have much of a set at all, and it's just amazing what gets done with the set pieces that we've got. So small theater maybe forces you to do that because you don't have a big budget to throw around.
Absolutely.
And yet it's funny how you have to be discerning in the small theater. When we did my show in August, and it was a fun production, very, very simple, and we just used blocks, theater blocks, right? Just plain old theater blocks. They became everything. They could just be everything in the show, and that worked really well. I thought with this show, even though we would have a, just a bit of set and a room divider and some chairs, we'd bring out the theater box from the basement of Theater 80. We brought them up on stage, and it's not about Theater 80's blocks, but in the context of the show, we were just all wrong.
They warned us, actually.
Terrible.
Oh, wow.
So I thought, no, the blocks are going back down right to the basement, and we used chairs, and the chairs just fit our minimal concept as units that had to move around the set, as per a show that didn't have a big budget, but that could still be have a sort of modular quality to it. So within the framework of small theater, there was still like a delineation about how this could work as opposed to this, that could work.
Mm-hmm.
And that was an interesting
and music
discovery.
Music stands turned into artist easels and various other things.
Pieces of furniture. So it's sort of like you let your imagination go with it, you're fine. If someone sits there saying, well, this should be a bigger budget, you know, there should be a living room, or there should be a settee, or there should be an artist classroom, then you're already lost. And as long as you can meet the people, I feel like people's imaginations can be spurred by the smallest suggestion, and they'll go with you.
And once they are, they're paying more attention to the text and the acting.
Right.
Because they're not distracted by a quote-unquote realistic fancy set. So.
And to your one point, Sean, about small theater, it also, it's a personal thing. It takes me back to my roots when I was playing in all these little theaters. All these little theaters don't even exist in the East Village. On Bond Street and Great Jones Street, and of course La Mama with Tom O'Horgan and Eve Miriam and all these people from the, you know, the past of theater. So there's something very, very rooted in it for me personally.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel like these people that we're working with are getting a little bit of the sense of how that all is or was. So that's neat for them.
And yet people are still making theater in unlikely spaces. It's just spread out a bit geographically in New York City. Again, thanks to the fact that I've been working with young people who then want you to come see them in other things.
Right.
Behind an art gallery in Chinatown or on 36th Street on the third floor, those places are not where you'd have gone when we first came to New York, but now you have to seek those places out because people are to put their shows on.
It's amazing because David and I, although we've come to New York many, many times, we were both born and raised in Southern California, and because of what we wanted to do with our play and our careers, we moved to New York 2.5 years ago, and I am just amazed at how many new theaters, not new theaters, but a new theater to me that I go to.
Mm-hmm.
I'm like, there's a theater over on, you know, on 8th Avenue and 42nd Street, and like, where would
where
that theater,
it?
Okay, go in there and go up four floors, and then there's this giant theater, so.
Yes, it's amazing.
It's amazing to discover all of that.
These venues start to remind me a little bit of London, and London in some ways, I think, to us is our holy grail, because you've always been able to find unlikely little theater spots away from the West End in London.
Really?
Oh, yes. We've had plenty of experience.
There are lots of above-the-tavern theaters.
Yeah, they're really big on things
of
above and behind the pub-type theaters that we've seen stuff at in London.
And in fact, one of the fellows in the show, who is
British,
said, now the thing for young people in London is young people. They go to the theater, and then they go out drinking.
but they're
going to the theater.
But they're going.
Yes.
Right.
So
right.
That's a whole interesting knowledge about the newer generations.
Wow. That's definitely new information to me. I mean, I think when David and I go to London, or anybody that travels to London that's a theater lover, you will focus on the West End. You will focus on the big shows that are there, and so it's good to know that.
Yeah, it's a very rich vibrant fringe scene in London, and we've seen some really amazing stuff in very unlikely spaces.
Wow.
And that's New York should
a stage
be
about
like
the size of this table.
Yeah. Wow. Right. Exactly. It's literally the audience right, that we're here right, right now, right? Right. With three people around and they're standing on the table. I'm going to have to get some of our friends from London on the show. I keep trying to do that to talk about that.
That would be interesting. That would be very interesting.
Yeah. It's great to hear about other people's theater culture. Mm-hmm. So, wow. Cool. We've had Sean Denyer and Howard Lodge from the Dublin Gay Theatre Festival on as well. I don't know if you know them, but anyways.
We know Brian Merriman.
Brian Merriman, right. They work with Brian quite a bit. Mm-hmm. Okay, what should every theatrical artist, writer, director, actor, technician be doing right now to be relevant and successful in the industry?
I would say, just from my point of view, find something that speaks to you and embrace it. Because the more you keep looking from other people to provide you opportunities, the less you're going to be satisfied or happy or have a continuing career. I've been an actor, now I'm suddenly a director too. I don't know if I want to be an actor anymore, but I've created opportunities for myself which have led to all kinds of other things that I wouldn't have had the richness of experience of if I hadn't just gone ahead and said, okay, I'm going to do this one-man Oscar Levant show that was out there for a brief time, and suddenly it's all over, you know, I'm doing it all over the place. So, and I get to get up and stand for an hour and a half, just me and the audience.
Sure.
So those kinds of things don't happen unless you seek them out more than wait for people to come up with the idea for you.
So
I would say that's the thing. That's what I tell people to honor. Honor something that speaks to you that you really want to do and go with it.
Excellent, Lance.
I think Chuck pretty much summed it up. It's a matter of being yourself and going after what you're passionate about. I think you cannot let yourself get caught. We had a young person in one of our shows who clearly wanted to be a star without being an actor. And that road leads nowhere, as far as I'm concerned, for people in this particular business. And you do have to recognize it as a business. It's been very interesting and sobering to see what it costs to put on even a modest production. And you cannot go into it blind. You do have to act like a business person and budget and et cetera. And we're coming in just bright, slightly under budget on this one because I looked at it all really carefully before we went in, and that's a piece of it people involved in theater don't like to talk about, but I think you need to have that. You need to say, is this possible, and can you do this, and can you do this without exploiting your cast? Because we mix non-equity and equity people. We follow equity guidelines and we pay everybody the same amount.
The Outsiders on Broadway tells the story of finding where you belong when the world refuses to accept you. Based on Essie Hinton's beloved novel, featuring new music from Jamestown Revival and Justin Levine, and directed by Danya Taymor, Entertainment Weekly says that, with brilliant staging and some of the most captivating stage fighting currently on Broadway, The Outsiders has the power to inspire an entire generation. Get your tickets today at outsidersmusical.com.
And I wouldn't want to do it any other way.
Excellent. Very respectful. Love that. That's terrific, you guys. Okay, now before I ask you what you're working on, that's new, that you haven't talked about already, if there's something you want to talk about, and ask you to give us social information, do you want to do a speed round with me?
Do what?
A speed round?
Sure. A speed round.
Sure.
Okay. You've been tipped off a little bit on this, so, okay. Ready? What's your favorite play?
Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf?
That's easy. I'm doing badly already on the speed round, but anyway.
That's okay.
That's okay. Go ahead. Skip. Pass.
Are you passing?
I'm passing.
Okay, you can come back to it if you want
to.
Sure. Favorite musical?
Sunday in the Park with George.
Okay.
Probably Cabaret, but Beautiful is, I would love to, because it's not just a jukebox musical, it's about the art of songwriting, and the book is much underrated.
It's so good. I love
it's
that show.
It's terrific, and the idea of combining Man and Mile with Carole King and Jerry Goffin was brilliant.
I love that. And it's the only time I've ever stage doored anybody with my stage door dancing Mueller. And she was super nice. Yeah. She's very nice. Like, from Chicago, too.
Yeah.
Her family is like theatrical royalty in Chicago. Mm-hmm. Okay. I digress. Wow. Favorite writer?
Stephen Sondheim, but I do want to call him on not going with the gay stuff and not really writing gay stuff when he should have been. So there you go, Stephen, if you're listening.
Fair enough.
He was on a panel when I was in the ASCAP Musical Theater Workshop, so he, I was there listening to him, so he can listen to me for a moment.
Oh, okay. You didn't bring that up when he was
not,
on.
No,
oh, okay.
I just feel like he had such ample opportunity to transcend that.
I agree.
As much as I love what he's done, I don't know. I just, that's a small pet peeve.
I'd agree. So I would. He had an opportunity to do that. He could have taken it. Yeah. Okay.
This will sound really awful, but I'm my own favorite writer. If I don't like what I do, who's going to?
Okay. Works for me. Favorite director? Are you your own favorite director?
No, I like what I do. I feel like, but I was just suddenly Robert Altman came to mind, just because of his ability to pull different characters into a story, disparate characters, and make them work in a grand design.
Yes, he's very, very organized. Mm-hmm. Robert Altman.
Yes,
that's what I would call it. Very organized, and he starts with good scripts, anyways. Mm-hmm. So it works.
That makes
sense. It works.
So
and he's organized by making it seem not organized because you have the overlapping dialogue and all that sort of thing, which is, of course, how people really talk.
Oh, yeah.
So I like that about what he does. I'll go along with Chuck on this.
Absolutely. And he's directed theater as well.
Yes.
Didn't he direct Come Back to the Five and Dime, Jimmy Dean, or was that Mike Nichols who directed that? Anyway, okay, that's the brain teaser. Every once in a while, I throw out a brain teaser.
Someone can call.
Yeah, somebody can send me like an instant message.
Exactly.
Okay, have you figured out your favorite play yet, or no?
It's I don't think of any one play that just kind of that I went back to again and again. I do that occasionally with musicals. I don't do that so much with plays.
Okay.
Obviously, yeah.
It could be a tie.
We were at... You know, it's really...
I've been ties on the show before.
It's also very interesting because, like I said, I had a course here at Vassar on great American plays, and it was really interesting to read. Here's one that's nearly forgotten that I just think is brilliant, and that's Night Mother.
Night Mother?
Yeah. We saw it when it had its Tony-winning run, and then I read it as a 50, 60-something with a bunch of college-age kids here at Vassar, and I thought, this play is just so tight and so wonderfully done because it happens in real time, and your sense of dread throughout it just grows, and I just, wow, I admire that. I would love to be able to write something quite like that.
I have never seen the play.
It's devastating.
Did you see
it's done right? We saw it with Kathy Bates and Patoniak.
Yeah,
and it's devastating. It's done right. It's obviously not the cheeriest thing, but it sure hits home.
Wow, I would love to see that on stage.
And alternately, since this was the same class I was in, I read Fences and realized how good it was, and then we saw the movie, and it doesn't hit it.
No?
No, Fences is really meant... Some things are meant to be on stage, I think, and I think Fences works as a stage play. And I think Night Mother does, too. And maybe the best plays don't translate so well to cinema. I don't know.
Sometimes they do, and sometimes they don't. You're right. Now, that was Marcia Norman wrote Night Mother, right?
Right.
Yeah, I really like her writing.
Yeah, this to me, it's just kind of a masterpiece. It sounds like an insult to say small masterpiece, but it's exactly that because there's something so intimate about it, the way it's written and what it's dealing with.
Oh, yeah. Well, it's a two-character play.
Yeah.
And you need, dynamite actresses to do it.
Yes, you do. You do.
For sure. And, wasn't that one of Anne Patoniak's first plays? Like, she started...
They have been.
She started, as an... I remember reading as an actor, in her 50s or 60s or something like that. Wow. That's... maybe the next, I don't know, somebody do that play again so I can see it. Just for me. Okay. Lastly, do either of you have a mentor?
I'll answer first because it's easy. No.
No? Okay. That's there have been people who
that arrogant guy who likes his own writing. There you go. No.
That's okay. Yeah.
If I had a mentor, he would not know about it at all. But the fellow who I took a class with when I was working on my play, and actually a lot of it takes place in Chicago, mm-hmm. the thing we did in August, I had originally planned it as a solo piece. And he suddenly said, Arthur Giron, who's written you know, a variety of plays, he's involved with the Ensemble Studio Theater. This was in the 90s, and this class was at Primary Stages. And he said, well, even if you want to keep the play as a solo piece, take the characters and the scenes and write them out. You can always write them back.
Sure.
But once they got written out, they were really interesting. And so the characters remained in the play. So I feel like he sort of mentored me in a weird way with that play that we did in August. And nobody else is jumping out.
At the risk of being stating the obvious, there's no way I could have done this last year and a half without Chuck. He's got the theater experience, and he's got all those years as an actor, which makes it so transcendent when he deals with younger actors particularly. I don't have that. I have the words. And I keep close watch on the language because I'm a wordsmith. But that way I think we maybe complement each other.
Aww.
But Lance is also good at communicating with people. And he's always a very good arbitrator. And there's another word that's not arbitrator.
Diplomat.
Diplomat, yes. So he has that quality.
That's adorable, you guys. That's so nice. Wow. I basically just do whatever David tells me to do, and that's the way that all works.
Yeah, neither one of us does that.
Okay. Is there anything new that you're working on that you haven't already talked about in the show that you'd like to talk about?
Not particularly, only in the regard that we have this body of work that we're trying to get out there. So the newness is when it gets out there and produced, I would say, for the things that we have right now.
Okay.
You're catching us at an interesting time. We have, in the last year and a half, done Animal Story, the musical we wrote when we were in our 20s, twice. We've done a shortened version of Morning Becomes Ridiculous. We've done Running for My Life, Chuck's play, which needs to have another production, preferably in Chicago, because I think Chicago people will really relate to it. But it's also very 90s, and it's very interesting how the 90s are now far enough away that people look back on that with nostalgia.
Right.
We created a soundtrack to go with it. In Love with the Arrow Collar Man is not intended to stop with this production, but we just have to see where we go with it. And meanwhile, we're still doing readings every Memorial Day and Veterans Day, particularly for Flower of Iowa, my novel. So, which would make a good miniseries.
You know, I knew it was a reach when I asked that, because when you've got six projects that are rolling, that's great. And I think a lot of writers and artists envy that, because it sounds like a lot of stuff that you had sitting to the side that you've written that was really, you now have an opportunity to bring all of that out and show it.
Yes.
I mean, I have, God knows I have 6 or 7 different things that I would love to put on the front burner now. So what an enviable position to be in.
So we're happy with that, actually.
Good.
To be in the place we are.
Good.
We are. He has one of his other musicals that he wrote with David is really good, Starboard Home. And I would love to see another production of that next, maybe. But we'll
so see. it just depends.
What a charmed time.
Yes.
That's great. Now, do you ever have to tell yourself, okay, just stop and realize that this is all happening? Once again, we're going back to the psychology of success. I'm sorry.
I have a tendency to tell...
all my insecurities.
I have a tendency to tell him that specifically. I said to him when we were, having a rough time recently during putting this together, I said, can you imagine your 22-year-old self thinking that 40 years later you would have directed 6 things in a row in New York?
Yeah, so. Could you imagine it?
Not at all.
No?
No, it didn't even occur to me. Right.
No?
Not at all.
Wow. Well,
so
it's
so
excellent.
Here we are.
Here you are.
Oh, yeah.
That's amazing. Okay, if you guys could give me any or all of your social information, and that would be terrific.
Well, the In Love with the Arrow Collar Man has a Facebook page, which
Great.
Is Arrow Collar Man on Facebook.
Cool.
And since I'm here, even though it's a novel, Flower of Iowa has both a social media a Facebook page, Flower of Iowa, as in the state, and a website, flowerofiowa.com. And then Chuck has a Facebook page.
Well, it's just a Facebook page, but there is a page for that started as the Oscar Levant Show, but it hasn't been updated or anything. So the best place to reach me is through his things, because they're much more updated.
Okay,
we have wonderful publicists who keep these things up, because
Good.
I'm not. Somehow social media became a bridge too far for me, even working in communications. So we have these great publicists who keep those things up.
Oh, you know, I just brought on a publicist for this show, and I'm like so glad that I did. It's they do so
it's
much
really
good.
Helpful.
It's
yeah.
it's mm-hmm. if there's anything that's like boosted the profile of your program as your ticket, it's my publicist
that's
Andrew
right.
Alton. So
yeah,
I totally
yeah
get
our publicists Jay Blotcher and Ellen Klein are really good. And it's funny because when I came to Theater 80 and we were talking about signing the contract, I said, "Oh, they'll take care of this." And the person I was dealing with said, "Oh, we get so many people come through here, say they feel like their publicists are worthless." I said, "Not me.
Oh.
Not me. I got really good publicists."
Yeah. Yes. Yeah. If they earn their money,
yep.
you're aces. Wow. Well, thank you for being with us, guys.
Thank
this
you,
was
Sean.
Great.
Pleasure. Thank you, Sean.
A pleasure.
Will you come back?
Oh,
sure.
Absolutely.
Please.
Absolutely.
Oh, great.
I even come to New York.
That would be great.
We do live in New York and Poughkeepsie. So.
Well, it was a nice field trip for us.
Go good.
So we can get out of the city for a day or two. You guys were terrific. An amazing interview. And I'm just so thrilled that we could have you on the show.
Thank you
thrilled
so
to be
much.
Here. Thank
oh,
you.
It's my pleasure. Now, at the end of each show, I like to give shout-outs to current productions worth a recommendation. On tonight's show, I'd like to recommend a new play presented by Roundabout Theater in New York City. It's called The Last Match. It's written by Anna Ziegler and directed by Gay Taylor Upchurch. Now, here's the synopsis straight from the Roundabout Theater website. Here it is. You've given it all to reach the top of your game. Now, where do you go from here? That's the question at the heart of Anna Ziegler's new play, The Last Match. It's the semifinals of the U.S. Open, and two tennis greats are facing off in the match of their lives. Tim Porter, the aging All-American favorite, wants to prove to the world, his wife, and himself that he's still a champion. Hot-headed rising star Sergei Sergeyev, that's his name, and well, that's his name in the play, struggles to believe he truly deserves to beat his lifelong hero. So, there you go. It's excellent with well-paced performances, and not just from Wilson Bethel and Alex... I'm sorry, Alex, if I'm going to butcher your name. Mikowicz as the two tennis pros, but also the ladies in the cast. The ladies are Zoe Winters and Natalia Payne, and they play wives in the story. But don't let that throw you. All of the characters are full-fledged, multidimensional people, and just very, very vivid and terrific character studies. The themes are universal, they're relatable, and they're about something we were talking about earlier, ambition, drive, and focus. I especially like the emphasis on the psychology behind sports, what it takes to keep your head in the game and manage the stresses of personal life as well as deep insecurities while participating in fierce competition. If you're somebody who is in competition, you will understand that. It's about keeping your head clear and keeping focus. That's really hard. They actually have therapists for sports. If you don't like tennis, it won't matter. If you don't like sports, it won't matter. It is a very, very good show. The Last Match is playing at the Laura Pels Theater in New York City until December 23rd. You can visit www.roundabouttheater, that's theater with an R-E.org, that's .org, just remember that, roundabouttheater.org, for tickets and information. Well, folks, the proverbial 11 o'clock number has been sung and the bows have been taken, so it's time to lower the curtain. I'd like to thank my guests, the sensational Lance Ringel and Chuck Muckle. Thanks, guys, again.
Amazing.
You can find more episodes of Your Program Is Your Ticket at facebook.com/programisyourticket. I'm on Twitter at @programticket. The website is yourprogramisyourticket.com. I'm on iTunes and SoundCloud. Rate me, write me a review. I got a review the other day. It was so wonderful. Subscribe. Folks, take a little time to see a show this week, and don't forget to give a smaller show some love. There's lots of theater gems out there. Until our next show, good night, theater people, and curtain.
The Outsiders, S.E. Hinton's generation-defining novel, is now a powerful and moving Broadway hit that the New York Post is calling the best new musical of the season so far. Don't miss your chance to join Ponyboy and the Greasers and experience the classic story come to life in a whole new way. The New York Times calls it refreshing, gritty, and endlessly effective. So get your tickets today at outsidersmusical.com, and of course, stay gold. They say well-behaved women seldom make history. Just ask the Supps. A vibrant and wholly original new musical, Supps celebrates the real women who changed history and their story that is more timely than ever. See the show Variety calls an epic tour de force new musical. Deadline Cheers is a rare Broadway feat and leaves audiences inspired to keep marching. Supps has arrived on Broadway, and not a moment too soon. Get your tickets today at suppsmusical.com.